All right. Welcome back to Punkonomics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, yeah.
That's Hello, welcome back.
My Beavis voice. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, you know, what to do about it, right? I mean, well, I don't have an easy solution. Right? And we discuss it regularly on the show, don't we, right?
So, have your own little garden, maybe.
Well, that's a great point in the sense that I disagree.
Well, yeah.
It's a wonderful thing.
Not in my house, because I have all cinder blocks and rebars and stuff like that they use to fill up
my backyard. I witnessed that and I saw it. Like
George Bush's baby brother, or he's the older one, right, Jeb?
Yeah, right. Oh, I don't know.
Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, be careful! But do not make the mistake. You know.
Yeah, do not make the mistake.
And Jeb is definitely nothing. He's not even an intellectual. He's not even like his brother assumed the position of trying to be kind of a, you know.
It's
a lovable redneck, despite being like an old money rich northwesterner, northeasterner, and but no, dumb, no. I mean, maybe ignorant a little bit, maybe, yeah.
Jeff could be even more of a dangerous, because he is an intellectual.
Maybe not. On the contrary, maybe that'll not allow him to be followed by the disabuse crowd. I mean, you know, it gets complicated, by the way. Let me plug again. One of my favorite all-time books is Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from the American Heartland, written by a kind of American socialist coming from West Virginia, kind of, about his people, you know, and precisely dealing with this issue of why are rural poor whites so conservative, right? Wasn't Obama famously said, you know, they love their Bibles and their guns, right?
Yeah.
Why do they clearly seem to espouse policies that are against their interests, you know? Because they suffer maybe not as much as urban blacks, but almost, you know, they're the next in line. They have no hope. They get, you know, so very bad. So this whole like the rednecks. Look, I can say redneck on the radio, can't I?
I can say
the equivalent for urban blacks. So I mean, I don't want to get into that horrible business that happens in radical circles, you know, about who's more suppressed than the other, and therefore that kills the solidarity and collaboration, which is really the only hope for a solution when rural, you know, conservatives, you know, in a Bible thumping, assault rifle carrying, you know, meth smoking, sorry. I'm using stereotypes here, so might as well, right?
Right.
You know, in the South there, they have to realize that their brothers are the inner city blacks, you know,
right.
And when they get together, they'll be changing, you know, then there'll be real change for the better, right? So it's a wonderful book, by the way. It's a wonderful, moving, funny.
I've seen that concept on Sons of Anarchy, which I've been watching.
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, yeah, yeah. Once again, to what I was saying, like the artists are doing some good work out there that I think is good nudging your mind,
mm-hmm.
right?
They don't mention the Native Americans at all.
Well, what's left of them? Talk about no. I mean, yeah, right.
I mean, you know, that's
they could.
Point.
I mean, they could. I suppose if we're playing that game, you know, of who's been screwed worse.
Yeah,
right.
The Native Americans, I suppose, quietly, you know,
and
win the game.
They're still here, you know. Yeah
absolutely.
Well, I mean, they were exterminated. I mean, you know, like no other people in history before. Like what, 99.7%?
Exterminated and shoved off to one section of the country.
And they continue
where they
to
can't
be
get
so.
Out. Yep.
You know, they're like raped, beaten regularly. You have horrific stories going on today. Of course, like the conservative white rural poor and the urban black urban poor, their leadership is often what black socialists in Black Agenda Report call the black misleadership.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So they also have the kind of casino rich lobby connected Native Americans
mm-hmm.
driving Rolls Royces while their sisters across the street are getting, are in really bad shape, very, very bad shape.
Liquor stores in every corner.
I mean, there's a horrible thing going on in the reservation now where people are kind of going in, people are going into the reservation because there's no rule of law. So people from outside, non-Native Americans, they go in, they kidnap a young girl, they you know, savagely
do
rape
whatever.
Her,
mm-hmm.
torture her to death, and go back home. That's a weekend. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's horrible, and there's absolutely no rule of law about it. So they're just gone. Nobody can follow them. Nobody has jurisdiction. It's
so. Are there any laws to protect, like the Native Americans, for example, provide them free housing,
protect them from
jobs or something like that?
They're their own nation,
right?
They're their own nation.
No,
and that's what it is.
Yeah,
that's one way of the U.S. government not spending any money.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of it's the heritage of this horrific. Genocide. You can't call it something. It's true, though, that the majority of the death came through disease initially.
Right.
But those who didn't die from disease, that
got shot.
Were murdered and tortured, and you know, we. So in some sense, we still have concentration camps that we never even shut down. You know,
And then you just never hear them, though. So you. It's like.
What?
So when is it going to be like a president of the United States, a Native American?
Oh, good luck.
You know.
Well, you know. And again, does it matter? Once again, it's a
It doesn't matter, but it's just
our
symbolic.
Our system,
you know?
Worked better than most. Go back to that enlightenment they keep talking about, right? The late 1600s, early the 18th century, early 1700s, where the world, especially in Britain first, but in other Holland, other places too, America, this modern world came to be. So that system kind of evolved and did some really good stuff. I like to joke with my mostly conservative type of more right-wing students than others and tell them that when you ever argue with a Marxist or a real leftist, your Trump argument to use is look at the last 250 years. Sure, there was a lot of horror, but there was horror before. But for the first time in history, more than a couple of percentage points of the population escaped subsistence. Lived better than just barely surviving. So in some sense, the Western, we call it liberal tradition, classical liberal, right? Because we're not talking about I can't say that word. The diet progressive, or diet socialist that we call liberals in America. No, I'm talking about the kind of the free market, individual liberties. That's what liberal means all over the world and even in American academic circles. It's very confusing and unnecessarily so, right? So all of that, world, brought significant improvement to a lot of people. With a lot of big caveats, mostly in what happened to Africans and especially African Americans, which is, you know, and in many ways, we should have a whole show on that. I'm still digesting this book, you know, about just basically proving that the entire Western industrialized world was built on the bones of African Americans. It was like the entire industrialization, all of that wonderful stuff.
Starting from the sugar all the way up.
I'm going to the cotton. Sugar is horrible. Sugar precisely is a horror story. You know, where the French pâtisserie built on the backs of you know, hundreds of thousands of worked to death, tortured Haitians, or at the time Hispaniola, yeah? Absolutely. But I'm talking about the horrible irony of how industrialization that eventually did lead to a reasonably functioning capitalism, sure, not exactly, you know, working conditions for the poor in Europe, not great, still not great, but in America, the struggle, they start, education, higher skills, standard of living go up, public health to a point, you know, better, not good, better. Mm-hmm. All of that was built off in the industry, in the 19th century, I'm talking now. You see, not the horror of different episodes, you know, but in the 19th century, what made the factory, the high productivity, industrialization, the industrial revolution take off? In 50 years, the price of cotton, and cotton was primarily, I mean, 80% of the industry was cotton production in industrialization, yeah? It was a precipitous drop in the price of cotton. And that drop was brought about through the labor and torture of African slaves. Now, I mean, you know.
So now it gets really deep in that, the book.
Yeah, the numbers. Yeah. Man, price went down by 75%.
Oh, no.
Of raw cotton from America.
Whoa.
And usually, people make often the distinction if they're not learning history from the Texan Board of Education, and then it's like, you know, Sieg Heil, tra-la-la, yeah? I don't know how to say it in any other way, but no, I mean, please, right? I mean, you know, if you don't exercise, if you don't see your past sins for what they are, then you're not redeemed, I mean, right? I mean, excuse me for getting all spiritual here all of a sudden, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But the story is awful in the sense that early African enslavement, you know, the majority of slaves actually went to Brazil and Haiti. Well, today's Haiti. The vast majority of slaves from Africa, of the 20% of the continent's population that was kidnapped, about 20% at least, conservative measures, maybe more.
Wow.
Yeah? Only about 5% went to North America. How weird is that, right? To the initial colonies. We're talking now really like the 1700s here, yeah? Right. Early even, mm-hmm. the beginning, yeah? Okay. Well, yeah, the 18th century, the 1700s. The thing is that they were worked to death pretty much in Brazil and in the Caribbeans, right? So they never really grew in population. You had to get new ones. That's why so many of them actually were brought there.
Mm-hmm.
In America, like I said, only 5% were brought to America because their conditions in Virginia, Maryland, Carolinas, you know, the old colonies in the 18th century were relatively much better. So yeah, were almost all the women raped repeatedly? Yes. Were people whipped regularly? Yes. Were they kept at subsistence? Were they worked really hard? Were they treated as animals?
Check mark.
Yes. Yes, they were. But still, they weren't worked to death. They were valuable. Their owners, you know, wanted them to have babies, both between themselves, and even better, the result of rape. Because remember how the science,
right.
in quotation marks, worked back then. You know, if you raped your slave, if a white man rapes a slave, the baby is half white. So we're not giving him any rights, that's for sure.
right, that's good.
We're good there. But, genetically speaking, scientifically speaking, it's a better creature, isn't it? It's got better genes. So they were raping these 12-year-old, 13-year-olds on a regular basis. But not just because they were dirty old men, that too, surely, but because they felt that this was improving their stock, you know? And you see, if you rape your cow, it doesn't work like that. But
now that
or
happened.
They would, surely.
That happened in the
1890s. Well, not yet.
Not yet.
This is what happened. So this happens in the early days, right? In the 1800s, in the 1700s, right?
1700s, right?
Sometimes toward the end of the 18th century, towards the 19th century, where really we don't even have industrialization yet. Remember, the first really like factories and all that in England too is like we're talking. Early 19th century at the very first, right? Even more like 1830s. So before industrialization, before factories that were driven so overwhelmingly by the production of cotton, because cotton used to be a luxury good produced since the dawn of time in China, in Egypt, in several places in the world,
mm-hmm.
but it was a very luxury good. If you consider that in Europe until the mid-19th century, only the very rich had access to cotton. Everybody else lived in wool. And linen too, but that was also expensive. Wool underwear, wool shirts, wool beddings.
Oh, that's hard, man.
Yeah, right? Just think of the world of cotton here for a second. You know how important cotton is, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's the core product mm-hmm. of the modern world.
Now you get it from cotton. Walmart very cheaply. But
we live all over. Cotton is huge. I mean, now we have so much more.
Right.
But back then, that was the thing. That was the good. That was the iPad of the time, you know? Cotton underwear.
Right.
That you owned that and a wooden spoon and you were a happy person.
Okay, yeah.
But again, jokes aside, right? So what happens is that early plantations were pretty small affairs, right? We're talking about a dozen slaves. Maybe 20. 30 is a huge plantation. 30 slaves. It's like a fortune. And they were expensive too because, you know, they calculated they were hardworking. And that you could breed them, so you could, you know, the financial calculation of just what the value of a healthy slave is.
Right.
And they kept them, you know, in relatively good condition. I mean, submitted, you know, all of those horrible things, but healthy. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Then came the Southwest. Now, the Southwest in this era, we're not talking about New Mexico. We're talking about Mississippi and Louisiana and Georgia, to also. They're cutting down the jungle. roughly, yeah, pretty much a jungle. I don't know if it's technically a jungle exactly, but it sure looks like it.
Right, right.
And growing cotton. And this is large scale now. So at that period of time, they were surely still doing their, I mean, this cotton is 19th century. The old slavery of the 18th century is indigo, rice, tobacco. Primarily, and of course, vegetables, stuff like that, right? But, you know, those are the big, the crops, the cash crops that are sold up north and sold to Europe, primarily. Now cotton comes along, and there's technological advances, looms and spin ginnies and all these technological advances and factories in Europe, and standard of living is rising and all of that, massive demand for cotton goods. So you can sell it at top price, as much as you can produce. They're going mass production. We are in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, you know, up to the Civil War, where we're getting mass produced plantations where you had hundreds of slaves working. And this is a completely new world. So they were breeding them up in the southeast, like the old Dominion kind of area, and walking them down to Mississippi and Louisiana, where their life changed dramatically. Now we're talking beatings to death. We're talking savage treatment, really, you know. Typical, tortured horrifically for productivity. So you have quotas established to people. And if you meet your quota, then means you can do some more. So, you picked 30 pounds of cotton? Because you're only a 6-year-old girl, you know, so. Living on barely enough food, right, and being whipped on an almost daily basis, and then raped. No, not yet. Mm-hmm. Soon. But, you know, you're picking 30 pounds of cotton, and by the way, you know, the business of picking cotton is
right.
horrifically right. difficult business, yeah, mm-hmm. physically. So, you made your quota today. Mm. Ah, so tomorrow's your quota is 5 pounds more.
No.
Ah, when you don't meet your quota, you get lashes with a cat of nine tails. Every whip digs into the muscle. Rips through the entire skin, right? Everyone, right? And sometimes you, on a daily basis, it's good to beat somebody to death every day. You have 300 slaves, you know, beat one to death, everybody
stays in line, right?
Stays in line,
right?
I mean, you wouldn't, I mean, you know, I have this kind of, you know, the Jewish humor thing going, right? So I'll say, like, I mean, these places made, you know, Auschwitz
yeah.
was kind of,
better. Disneyland.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if I can stay on the radio like this. This wasn't a picnic. No, it wasn't a picnic. But in some ways, you know, it's different, but just as horrific,
right,
if not
right.
more. Mutilations, right? Of course, when people escape, they cut their foot off and stuff like that.
So it was just run as a business. Pure
industrial business.
Industrial.
Now, why is this so exciting for an economic historian? Because since, and I posted when I went to Chicago, you remember I came back like
right,
all like
right.
rosy-eyed and kind of libertarian for a little while? a little bit. Cause actually the one of the keynote speakers there is like sitting with the guy, you know, is Stanley Egerman. So I know most people say like, who? Well, it's kind of, for an economic historian, it's like Taylor Swift, right? Even though he's like 94. So he did research, economic, historical, statistical research back in the 70s already, and wrote of the most famous book that he wrote with another guy was called A Life on the Cross, Time on the Cross. The puzzlement was that we typically in America learn that the Civil War brought an end to this obsolete institution of slavery. An old world, pre-industrial, pre-capitalist thing that was dying by itself. It was untenable. The North were industrializing, were developing. The South was backward plantation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wrong. Slavery was perfectly viable. Because it was underwriting the whole industrialization of the Western world that was that viable. They were way richer than the North. Except, of course, that the North were providing them with all the goods and services, all the banking and financial services, debt, credit, etc., etc., etc. Weapons, whips, probably. right? So everybody was growing off of that. It was the engine of growth. And there was no reason for it to stop, other than, you know, the abolitionist. I mean, it kind of brings back the honor of the Civil War, in a sense, that, you know, you had to go through that war to stop that horrific, genocidal, you know, monstrosity that was antebellum slavery, right? It wasn't going away by itself, right, at all. And even I would put to you that I read this stuff. I'm always thinking I've become with age less of a pure scholar in the sense that I only care about what I learn about now from history much more, right? So I'm saying like, we're going back there. I see that method. Why? Because Stanley Eggerman and people like him and economic historians, we're so used to always look for technological change in a modern world. It's always better technology with skilled labor and, you know, maybe then you need public education and a lot of other things like that to get that leads to rising productivity. Okay? That's how you get more productivity. By applying more capital, more machines, more skills. That's kind of, and that's in the best of all possible worlds. Yeah, that's when capitalism is a good thing. Yeah?
And that's how the world is sort of going to it.
That's what worked for these relatively good 250 years. Right. But always lurking under the surface, and that's what, so these economic historians who find that this institution of American kind of slavery in the 19th century is extremely lucrative, profitable, viable, and makes imminent economic sense. Of course, anybody decent thinks that it's horrible, but it's not, it's efficient. For economically speaking, they for several decades after that, people were writing entire theses in the best of schools, trying to figure out the productivity rise of the spin genie and the different looms and the industrial and eventually all of these technologies and how they raise the productivity of cotton production and other goods that derive from the cotton production industry afterwards. And we cannot explain the half of it. Actually, we roughly can explain half of it. Without technology. So the big mystery since the 70s until this book just now is we should interview him, by the way, one day. Well, we'll get around to it. So how did we get where's the productivity? Where is it? Right? And, you know, Edward Batiste in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told. No, it's reading my audiobook here. I listened to it. No wonder I have nightmares.
What was it called, The Half?
The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. By the way, Edward Batiste, Baptist, yeah? You'd be interested that it's a historical narrative, but he also uses testimony of just the last slaves, you know, collecting in the 20s and 30s. So it's a kind of an economic historical book, and it does quote numbers and stuff, but a lot of it is very poetic, you know. It's actually really good cool book. That way, you know. It's written in very literarily conscious tone, which I find a wonderful mix, actually, quite unique. So I'm really quite enthusiastic about it. Bottom line, it is possible to derive tremendous economic efficiency and thus massive profits, not through high-tech, high-skilled, you know, sophisticated capitalism, but through torture. That's where it came from.
So sort of what's happening in China?
You got that one person, it was considered to be impossible to do more than 50 pounds for an adult male in perfect health. Yet they got 120 out of them. How? Torture. So I'm thinking I'm thinking from the sweatshops around the world producing our goods, that we could pay them, you know, a little bit more. It wouldn't have really any impact on anything but the Christmas bonuses of the board of directors.
Right.
And they would still be able to have multiple private planes.
Mm-hmm.
One less, maybe.
So just to bring it back down to a smaller thinking. Mm-hmm. So you're saying it would have been great to be a shareholder for the cotton companies if it was. And then so that brings it back to right now. Is that, would it be a great thing to be a shareholder of the businesses that do? Yeah,
for a small elite.
Yeah,
there's no trickle down. You know, it doesn't happen. This is a you know, some elites and people who are not elite who are struggling and some of the minority people in the elite who are decent, forward thinking people have to take action for us to escape the plantation. It doesn't happen naturally. We don't, you know, it doesn't happen naturally. It takes struggle, recognition, ethics, religion, you know, it takes conscious effort.
So now I have a question for
We're never going to get to Rick, but...
Okay.
I don't know.
I mean, it's really interesting.
It's cool. Don't get me wrong. Maybe I should just... I'll compensate by posting a bunch of stuff on punkonomics.org. So people get a taste for it, at least see if they like it. You know?
That's good.
We're not committed to anything, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So my question is, you know, we're in the 21st century. Everything, you know, evolves. We have new technologies. We have new... you know, ways of doing things. We're smarter than before. We know how to do things very efficiently. I mean,
have you ever seen Idiocracy?
No.
Oh, yeah. We're dumber than we ever. We get dumber every generation.
I'll add it to my list.
When you're stupid, it doesn't stop you from having kids. In fact, often
right.
Yeah,
back to hating
more.
Breeders. But that's the one demographic I can hate on, right? Breeders, Jews, what else? You know?
But everybody
gets to hate on their own demographic, right? That's the rule.
True. Now, my point is, you know, you mentioned it in the 1800s, and that's how it's happening, sort of the same thing, you know, torture. And then now the same thing is happening in the sweatshops, right? Right now, it's just repeating itself. History is repeating itself. With new technological advancements and everything, and then you just get the robots doing all that jobs or these works.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Is it going to be different? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be repeated in history? Is it just going to be robots instead?
Well, it's never repeated, right? I mean, like, you know, the famous quote, right? Mark Twain, it doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. We see similar patterns, but they're different. They're similar, but they're different. So can we read the Roman history? See, Rome fell for income inequality. That's really what brought down the Roman Empire. Can we learn something? Hell yeah. But, of course, it's a very different world, Rome and America today. Very,
true.
Very different on so many levels. So, yeah, and even then, I mean, you know, this is a phenomenon. It's not that we're going back to exactly the same thing, but to me, the big lesson to learn is that there is no fancy word for it is teleology, you know, a direction, the kind of an inevitable direction. We're getting smarter, more efficient, more technologically advanced, higher standard of living. It's not in somehow an inevitability natural occurrence. It's a conscious struggle, ongoing, we can do better, what isn't working, let's try and fix it, what is working, let's make sure it keeps working. There's always the people who will predate, you know, the minute people have some power, they will exploit it. I mean, individuals might be good people and actually not, but you can't count on that because the majority will, so you have to check their power. All of this ongoing struggle. In fact, that's how I read Uncle Trotsky's concept of revolution and permanence, you know, and that's how I read the utter failure of, well, not utter failure, but overwhelming failure of the Soviet Revolution. They didn't get it. At least Lenin missed it, and well, Stalin, well, was Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Joe. but seriously, you know, this ongoing, constant, critical evaluation, we have to fix our problems, what are our problems, let's argue about how to fix them, let's have this functional argument, you know, not discussion, functional argument from multiple perspectives, etc. So, yeah, and we too often, as often empires or civilization at their peak, and you guys are, you know, you are a little young, so poor thing, you know. We lived in the good days,
right.
You know, the best times ever, you know, the post-World War II era, you know. A shout out to all the kids out there that are X generation and younger, that any time some old fart tells you, we had it, tell him, you know, smack him, well, no violence, right, but smack him metaphorically and tell him, you destroyed the world for us, leaving us in a heap of... you know, dung, and shut up. right, really? Yeah, we lived the good life. You know, now things are bad. Like wages are stagnating and falling again. You know,
right.
There's no recovery. There's no future if we don't do something about it. It's not going to fix itself. Right, isn't it the definition of insanity? They're trying to do the same thing, you know?
Over and over.
We had a crisis. We had multiple crises before, by the way. A pretty big one in 2008. And yet we have changed nothing. On the contrary, we kicked back to a lower gear and accelerated into the same wall. You know? Peoples and civilizations have done this before. You know, the Easter Islanders had an economy based on lumber, on trees. And they cut all their trees down, you know, to build big, big heads from stone. So you look at them, you know, you idiots,
right.
And they're kind of more or less extinct, yeah? Well, yeah, you know.
You know, it's really interesting. That goes to the psychology of humans, and maybe Jesse can add to that since he's an honors in psychology major. So what do you think of it when a human is in power and just getting that you know, from one source. They just, for example, lumber. Okay, we only have lumber. We only have this much left. Well, but they just still keep going.
They tend to go with the comfort zone. That's basically what it is. They tend to go with what they know.
But then they know what's going to happen.
It goes back to that old saying, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
But it is. Denial, yeah.
Yeah, it's downright denial.
Think about it. They're cutting those woods not even to make the statues. That they're making out of stone. To roll them to place. To place them in a nice... It's like landscaping, you know?
So just shifting to a lower gear and accelerating.
Yeah. But of course, what? The person who says, no, we can't do that. What are you talking about? Are you anti... anti-East Islanderism here, you know? Yeah. This is what we do. We build giant heads out of stone and place them strategically on the beach.
Right.
What do you mean we're all gonna starve, you commie?
You know, and
they said it surely then too.
And there's also a lot of programming behind it because, in the 80s and 90s, when it came down to labor relations, what management would tell labor is, well, to have good management, you have to pay them.
Mm.
You know, and the employee would go like, well, that kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. But where the employee missed the boat is that to have good employees, you also have to pay them. Mm-hmm. See, management knew that, but they just went like, okay, we can still steal from the employees, you know, off of their labor, keep it going like back in the slave days.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, and profit to no end until finally they start screaming like the abolitionists did back then.
And we don't have any more trees.
Right.
Yeah.
So that basically what it boils down to is that, you know, somebody comes down in the parade and goes like, oh, let's go down this way. Let's go down. You know, everything's going to be good. We're doing it for, you know, the motherland or the fatherland or for America, mm-hmm. you know. In the moment, there's one voice in the background that says, wait a minute. You know, this is not helping me. Then you're anti-American.
Exactly, yeah.
You're whatever anti, you know.
Anti-trees.
And the whole group. You know, because they're in a comfort zone and at that moment chastises new ideas.
But then they're just not thinking. So they're just not thinking. They're just listening to that one person.
Well, it's difficult to realize. I mean, it's difficult to see the big perspective on this sort of thing. And you're committed to it.
Right.
And it's a
big
leap.
You got to feed your children.
And what are
you
going to do? Right. Every day you have to do your thing. You know, mm-hmm. you have to
play
the game.
And it's the same process just like religion. You know, people don't really protest or say, well, you know, this doesn't make any sense. They just keep on following like sheep, you know. And then after a while, when, you know, people have been, you know, slaughtered, you know, in masses, then that's when people start going like, well, maybe there is something. Maybe there's something here that's wrong and we need to take a look at it.
So here, let's start drilling in
critical,
the ocean.
Right?
You know?
In the colleges, we say, and actually one of the last bastions, and this is being actively, I mean, the elites, lobbyists, tea partiers, and assorted... I didn't say the word. This is a Celtic word I used.
Right.
of the sort are attacking, academia and telling everybody, oh, these left-wing professors, watch out for them, you know, and whatever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, critical thinking, precisely, you know. Mm-hmm. Look at what everybody says. Yeah, this is how it is. This is how it always has been.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Really. I ask anyway, you know. I mean, that's what you're supposed to foster instead of yes, sir, or yes,
you know, ma'am. I'm glad you mentioned that because that was the one predominant thing that I saw in the labor when I was flying, mm-hmm. was that, you know, during the merger mania of the 1990s with the airlines picking up this airline here and this airline there, mm-hmm. you'd have the big airlines passing down that information to employees, and the employees would repeat it. They would say, well, it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And it's kind of like, well, then those of us who were in the smaller airlines that had new ideas that were able to survive and compete in that own market, would go like, well, wait a minute.
Right.
Why can't you do this? Well, we always done it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it always worked.
And it always worked.
And
exactly.
Exactly the same thing with the,
but things change. So what worked before does not, I mean, this is like a rule. If there is a rule of existence on the planet, I mean, that's the complete nature of the beast. You know, T-Rex said that too at some point.
Yeah, right.
That's how we always were. You know, well, guess what? You know, environment has changed. You better adapt. I mean, if there's one rule, right, is that you have to be able to adapt. That rule applies in biology. It applies in business. It applies in everything. You have to adapt. If you can't adapt, even if you're currently perfectly suited for your environment, you're the jewel of creation, you're doomed, just like T-Rex. Because mm-hmm. when the environment around you changes, and it always will.
Right,
it
always does.
Sooner or later, because things change. It's kind of the nature of the universe.
Right, and it goes back to the Big Bang.
And you can't,
keeps evolving.
If you can't adapt, you're out. Somebody else takes your place. It's kind of the same situation. So yeah, no easy solutions, but I mean, this questioning is a major part of it. It's kind of in my business, kind of, that's kind of what I do for a living primarily. But it's also seriously under attack, you know, this notion, happily I have a lot of support of, and I'd like to thank my students, whatever their ideologies or political leanings or classes. I mean, they kind of, the vast majority of them appreciate, the fact that I'm always there, like asking the difficult question. Always, oh yeah, how about that? How about this?
Right.
What about that? So that, you know, your brain, you keep
you're
dealing
thinking,
with
yeah, it. Yeah, you're thinking.
That's
you're not
critical
like,
thinking.
Exactly.
But we live in a world where, oh, don't be so critical, you know? We want cheerleaders. I got nothing against cheerleaders. Yeah, sorry.
Right.
Nothing personal. But, you know, let them do cheering. You know, you also have to have the people, not in a sport, I guess it's not important, right? That's a coach's job, I suppose, right?
Right.
To be the critical thinker, you know? Mm-hmm. No, that wasn't good. That could be better.
Right.
This is a problem. Otherwise, you're doomed.
And it's the same thing. Like you see a big example with the Fed when with the crisis as well. You're like when I think I saw a little part of the questioning when they I think the Congress was questioning him of whatever acts that they did. And then he said, you know, I've always done it before. I had it in this crisis and I did this and it worked. And I did it in this crisis and it worked. And I did it in this crisis and it worked.
To save the financial industry.
Yeah. And then they had nothing to tell him, you know. He's like, okay, so what do we do?
Incidentally, in one of the episodes of The Economic Update, by Professor Richard Wolff, that we'll post at least, he actually does mention in one of his little bits how he's not, I mean, Ben Bernanke is no longer chairman of the Fed.
Right.
Served under President Bush.
Oh, there was
and
the guy
President
before
Obama.
Him, too, the really old guy.
Well, yeah, the idiot.
Greensburg.
The greatest idiot of the 20th century.
That's the guy that I saw his questioning.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, okay, but he's a whole other even bag, I mean, in the sense that he was really like I mean, Ben Bernanke is a conservative, politically, clearly. That's why Bush picked him. It was he picked him. He looked for a leading conservative macroeconomist, and happily he chose it. Frankly, he did a decent choice there. He could have chosen, you know, Gregory Mankiw. Anybody, most people don't know about him, but he's the alpha douche of the economic profession. Ben Bernanke is a good conservative. At any rate, he quit. Well, he finished, right? I mean, now we have Janet Yellen.
Right.
Who's just basically the same policy, more or less, you know. Nothing radical here. Competent, what have you. But she's working within the system, you know. But Bernanke took a job. You think he retired? He took a job. Where do you think he took a job?
Goldman Sachs?
Close. Yeah. What do you think? You know? It's all revolving door. But what do you want him to do? You know what I mean? What do you want him to do? He doesn't have the luxury of being an ex-president like Bill Sweatshop Clinton. That's a nickname I gave him because of his work in helping the Haitians after the earthquake.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, I put you to work in my sweatshops. I'll deliver you to multinational corporations. But yeah, he can give speeches and collect mass amounts of money, right? So, you know, when you're president, you don't actually have to take a job, right? Of course, you're working with all these really heavy industry and allowing heavy economic interest, multinational corporations. You're delivering entire nations to their, how would you say that, to their gentle care, so that you know, there's a lot of not a problem. I believe the Clintons do not have a problem collecting donations. Mm-hmm. So I hear, right?
Right,
I wonder
right.
Why they're so popular among corporate America.
The global initiative.
Yep.
So, where do you start?
And he does it globally, too. Oh. I think he arranged one in Dubai right after he,
Oh, yeah, he does. Yeah, he's,
quit.
And he's not alone. I mean, he's a big player. You know, a lot of people point out of how corrupt they are. I mean, but I would say they're not like, you know, corrupt in the sense of, in the traditional sense of corruption. They're playing they're playing their hand. I mean, they're doing what do you want them to do?
They're just surviving through the system.
Surviving, and they have to pay the bills. Their bills are really big when you have multiple mansions.
Exactly.
A lot of expenses.
I would love to survive that way.
And if you have your own private jets.
But I'm just saying, it's not like, oh, look, yeah, the Clintons are so corrupt, so I'll vote for Ted Cruz because he's not corrupt. I mean, shut up, you know? I mean, what do you think? If he's not very... you know what? Probably Ted Cruz. And let's use Ted Cruz because, really, you know, there's not much to like, you know, he's a tool, he's a little tool. You know, he's a little rusty tool, you know. Nice plastic grip, you know what I'm saying? Like that nasty hard hammer that you drop, you put down and look for the good one, you know, when you're trying to do something around the house. But still, he's not corrupt yet. You know what I mean? He hadn't had a chance yet. Give him a chance. Yet. But it's a systemic problem. It's not an individual problem. We cannot replace individuals and hope for the best. So, you know, if somebody like a lot of progressives are all about like Elizabeth Warren and now Bernie Sanders, everybody exciting. And yeah, they're decent. Both of them are particularly Bernie Sanders, frankly, because he's independent. So, you know, deserves respect. But I'm thinking all he's doing is he wants to raise issues, somehow be able to speak, you know, and talk and be at least so they don't have this kind of party going on in the Democratic primaries, so that there's one guy there's calling Hillary, you know, out.
What it is, yeah.
And that's what he's doing, and probably hopefully will do a little bit. That'll be a healthy thing to do. If he ever intended or tried or somehow managed to be electable, he would have to be corrupt. He would have to be fake and betray all of the principles that people who like him for. Same thing. Look, here an example from the other side. You know, I like to say that Rand Paul had his moments, you know, has his moments, didn't he? When he was actually filibustering when Obama wanted to invade Syria, he had a nice moment there, you know. His daddy actually, agree with him or not, had some credentials, being non-corrupt and never allowed into the party, right? Always like the clown in the corner of the Republican Party, right? The foil, despite being popular and being the best guy among them. But Rand Paul is vying for really succeeding, right? It's a bit of a long shot for him, but he's trying to really be perhaps the Republican candidate for presidency in 2016. And therefore, he's turned into the complete beep. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right, yeah, no, he's completely...
Otherwise, he'll just be that foil like his daddy was, where people can, you know, use him to distinguish themselves from him and play against him, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not about people, it's about a system. And that was a really convoluted long way to kind of a little bit try and answer your question. We have to deal with these problems. There's no escape in looking at fundamental necessary changes to the way we go about organizing our life, the broad political economy. There's no escaping. And nobody has a clear answer, and nobody really in the mainstream has anything near a reasonable answer, quite frankly. You know, you can't go timid on this one, because everything's interconnected. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about some, it's not little tweaks.
Yeah.
We're talking about big, and that's very, a revolution, you know? And it doesn't necessarily involve violence and pitchforks, you know? Right. Think about the revolution that kind of in some sense started, or at least solidified, launched fully. Because history is all progressive, multiple strand, very messy business, right? But the glorious revolution of the 17th century in England, non-violent, right? Revolution, that's when the world, that word came to be. It's like a wheel that revolves, right? The entire system kind of changes phase. Things are done differently. And at the time, you know what? They faced similar challenges. The aristocrats were doing whatever they wanted. You could not make a rational economic system, efficient economic system, because aristocrats were enjoying a good existence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in America, you had to have a civil war. Very horrible, bloody, nasty one, unfortunately. To get to bring America to modernity. You know, that's what put America on the path to becoming, you know, a industrial powerhouse of the world.
Right.
It wasn't. It was a, you know, in slave-based, you know, agrarian society.
Right.
Like a third world country. So
it's not like you can escape it.
No. Times are difficult. There needs to be this. And now I'm always personally very hopeful. And break the two-party system is an absolute necessity. Foster a productive argument about what should be done. Because right now nobody's taking care of business. That's one of the things that's very difficult for us to wrap our minds around. This notion that, why are we doing this foolishness? Why aren't we doing all these things that have to be done? Why aren't we not? Because the incentives aren't there. And to go back to my horror stories of, horror story of slavery, you see, there's nothing forcing us to fix things, you know?
Right.
The decision makers, the proverbial 1%, is working beautifully. Now it looks like the stock market is going to probably lose like 30% in the near year or two. There's going to be a little bit of a small to medium sized bubble is going to go pop. So it'll be a little bit of a dampener for a while and shed even more jobs. You know, people don't realize there's no recovery. The wages are not going up. I mean, even the mainstream, I mean, we've been yelling it for since 2008 already. That there's not going to be a recovery. There is no recovery. Rick Wolf has been doing a lot of work yelling that out. Everybody's kind of trying to pretend squint that there is. You know, there's a few more jobs added. Oh, really?
Right.
At lower wages with no benefits, duh.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's not, you know? So why don't we understand that we must put money in the pockets of Americans to kickstart our economy again? It's not going to happen naturally.
It's called greed. It's basically blanket greed all around. People just are greedy now.
They were always greedy. They're not more greedy than before.
But now it's more legalized greed, more of accepted among themselves. Versus before, they had some kind of responsibility for their community. Now it's like, there's no responsibility for
the
community.
The culture and the economy are intertwined too. Like everything's intertwined. So it's true that the elites now are so wealthy and they are living unproductively. I mean, sure, they are productive people. You know, everybody's all Elon Musk, you know, I don't know. Right, fine. You know, he's definitely doing productive stuff, right? So no doubt inventing real things. But the vast majority of wealth, in the world is derived from financial tools, so parasitic really, and it's not even investing in new technology, not even investing, it's purely manipulation and speculation, so it's non-productive at all. More and more so, so a culture like that is different than the culture of those rich people in the earlier times that, as you said, had responsibility, they were still greedy in a sense, but in a productive way.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then you see all this stuff here in the United States, and then if you look at different places in the world, like for example China, you see the middle class growing like a weed, like weeds.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, because they can, but because there's still
shifting?
Potential for it. I mean, well, not.
There are more
mean,
people over there. There's
so much more
activity.
Right,
yeah,
no. But again, remember
but
about
it's a collective
China.
Society. You always remember that.
Yeah.
Oof, not anymore. Actually, one thing I do agree, I mean, it's actually along the lines you were suggesting earlier, that the culture changes very rapidly, almost instantaneously. So culture is no protection. You see, the fact that, raise your kids well, when the incentives are such within one generation, everything's changed. Mm-hmm. Economics trumps culture every time. So the culture does change easily. So in China, people are now not collectivist at all. They have no respect for their elders. I mean, those who are in the nouveau riche there. But I mean, this thing to remember also about China that it did some remarkable things in the 90s. I mean, you know, they peaked. I mean, they started earlier. In some sense, by the way, know that many of the good reforms in China started already under Mao. Just saying, you know. So it's not even there that, once we got rid of Mao, everything turned good.
No, there were
certain progressive changes.
Right.
Mao's time was over. He needed to go in a sense, but it was already happening when he was still around, to correct for the insanities of his earlier days, right? The great leap forward and all that. Don't forget that China has 1 billion people in it, roughly, much like India. But it's like, and these are very broad numbers here, 200 million people are in the loop. Right? I'm even including the sweatshop workers in those 200 million people. So when you have a 20 million new middle class people, that's a huge, you're right, that's giant,
yeah,
right? In America, we have like 20 million people falling from middle class to poverty in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
So obviously they're beating us in that 100%. But let's not forget the other 800 million whose life is worse every day. So, you know, in the 90s, they peaked. They achieved that amazing, like, no starvation in China, amazing success. But it's been stagnating in the past 10 to 15 years. Internally in China, the government even is talking about it again and again. They have to foster internal growth. They can't just use sweatshop labor to produce, you know, to produce goods to export to America.
Right.
Sure, it creates middle class to a significant extent, but a few tens of millions of nuans is not enough. So they, for 20 years, they've been talking about how we must start producing for the Chinese market, internal market. We need to produce cheaper stuff, yet, you know, cheaper for us to buy. You know, gadgets for the Chinese to buy, not just the management classes, the new management classes. So sure, all that giant boom has generated a tremendous amount of wealth there. Much of it highly concentrated to the top two.
Hmm.
You know, highly concentrated. You do have also a bargaining middle class.
Yeah.
But all this is in a 200 million people. That's a lot of people, right? America has what? 310 or something?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of people. But again, I mean, what about the other 800 million?
Yeah, and then even if you talk about India too, so that's another billion. That's
right, and they have also a tremendous middle class.
Yeah, yeah,
in some sense, they have some advantages over China structurally because they have a much more of an internal economy. So you have a lot of shopkeepers, service industry, you know, really little middle class. So maybe they're not middle class. If they came to America, they would be, you know, bottom middle class. But over there, they're upper middle class. But they have more internal investment. They have other problems, no doubt, including tremendous corruption and things like that that is keeping them back. But you see, at so many levels, there is an absolute need for taking a look at our system. It served us well, more or less. Some better than others, but overall did a pretty decent job, this modern capitalism, overall, with big caveats, yeah? It is kind of generally requiring a massive overhaul right now. And we're in denial, and elites are doing well just like the plantation owners. There was no need to be industrial, high-tech, middle-class American dream if you can rule, you know, your slaves and... For you,
it's life not is broken. Good. Don't
no need, yeah. Right? No need.
Well,
we got to wake up and
yeah, that's
get busy.
Hopefully, it won't be too late.
Yep.
All right. So, top of the hour. You know that web page called punkonomics.org.
Yeah. We keep posting stuff or trying as best we can.
Yeah. So that's where it's all at, and we'll be right back with. Julie Norris, who's standing in the other booth. Yeah.
Right. We're going to switch
porch
studios.
Radio. You've been listening to WPRK Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radio. And of course, this was Punkonomics. So we will leave you with, Iggy.
Iggy.
Yep. Louie Louie.
The news. Money is the reason to be. Makes me just wanna sing.